You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum, my good friend Rob Hollis. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing good. How are you?
We got a great guest today.
We do. Who?
We always have great guests.
Yeah, but who do we have this week?
You guys watch a show called Arrow. It's one of the biggest shows out there. That's huge. It's one of the, you know, this guy has millions of followers. He's a charitable guy. He's everywhere. He's
What's
a really good looking guy. His name's Stephen Amell. He's a hunk. He's got a huge following. We get really inside of Stephen. And in fact, he was on Unqualified on Anna Faris's podcast.
Yeah, they
right?
did a live show at a Comic Con.
And yes, of course. And they obviously produced this show. And guess what?
He said the smartest thing that Anna and Sim ever did was bringing you onto
the
network.
He says the show, he never opens up about his divorce, and he did. I got him to open up about it, but he said it was like, I don't know, it felt natural. And look, we talk about his divorce. We talk about so many things about...
Just get in and listen to this.
Yeah, I think you should just listen to this. I think you're going to really dig it. This episode of Inside of You is brought to you by...
The H Hemp Company.
Yeah, this company has saved me. I got to tell you. Their products are the real deal. If you want to relax, feel better naturally, you don't get high at all. So you don't have to worry about that. Because I know there's a lot of products out there, like, you know, CBD based and all this. But look, you take the H Hemp Company's products. They've been written about in magazines. You feel better. I use this balm and Rosenbaum. Yeah, dude, I put it on my, because I got neck issues. I got a herniation in my neck. I use it in my, I've had back surgeries, yeah, and I just feel better, dude.
Always complaining about being in pain, and ever since you started using this, it seems like you bitch a little less.
It's what I've been looking for, brah.
Yep.
I could take H-Hemp CBD and still function. I can go to hhemp.com, and I could try it, which you can also do. And if you use Rosie20, you get 20% off Rosie20. I know the guys there, too. They're freaking amazing guys. Stephen Amell, folks.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
I have a feeling not a lot bothers you.
No.
Is that true?
I'm pretty easygoing. I'm very particular, but I'm pretty easygoing.
Do you think you've always been easygoing, or do you think that...
I've been pretty easygoing since I moved out to LA properly in 2010, but the working on Arrow, and I can pretty much tell you what I'm going to be doing every day down to the minute, right?
So my structure.
My time has become incredibly valuable.
You have purpose every day. You do things that have some kind of purpose in your life.
Even if that means doing nothing, right? But I need to walk.
You need that.
I'm becoming a little like when I walk into a room, I need stuff to be organized.
Okay. Do you think this room is organized? This is the basement. This is the podcast screening room. For the most part, it's pretty organized, right?
It's pretty organized.
I cleaned up quite a bit before we started, though. You had a bunch of shit everywhere.
Really? Was it dirty?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you know,
practice left?
Yeah, I had band practice, and then I had an interview for, like, I did this movie called Urban Legend when I was like 26, and mm-hmm. it was a 20th anniversary. So they asked if they'd come interview me, but so they trashed my place, and then they didn't really clean up. So that's why it was a little messy. But thanks, Rob, for taking credit for cleaning my house.
You're welcome.
At the very least, there's some serious organization going on with the DVDs, and that's critically important.
How many people do you know have DVDs still?
One.
Who's that?
My buddy Jeff Brown. He has every DVD.
Blu-ray.
I think that he sold them when he moved to New York, but he would have everything. And I mean everything. Like, we would go through his stuff. And
I have laser discs upstairs in my bedroom, like Jaws Collector's Edition with the Peter Benchley book. I have Alien. I have, you know, people are like, you know, why don't you just sell these? I'm like, first of all, get $10 for this collection.
Right.
And it's all alphabetized, which is weird to some people, but why would you want to have a DVD collection and not know where to go find Jaws?
That makes perfect sense. No, because I was looking at it, and I'm looking at the TV DVDs up there, and you have Game of Thrones right after Friends. So I recognized immediately that it was alphabetized. That sort of stuff is important.
But you know what happens is that sometimes it gets like a little messy, especially when you're talking about TV shows and box sets. So this side is a little messier than the other side. I guess you guys would have to be here to see what we're talking about.
No, but why would you sell it? It's art.
It is art. You come down here and it kind of adds a little fun to the room, doesn't it? It adds a little bit like, hey, this guy's dated.
Do you own a DVD player?
Well, sure.
Okay.
Here's the great thing. I have a Blu-ray player, which is part of my Xbox. So you could play...
right?
Whatever you want in the Xbox,
right?
Do you own
right.
an Xbox?
No.
Do you have a PlayStation?
I haven't had a gaming system since Super Nintendo.
Stephen Amell, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today. This is we always just start. I was coming down from Hermosa. I thought I was going to be late. I was worried. You're a busy guy. Your time's important. And I was like, fuck, dude. He said 3 o'clock, and I keep going, hey man, what about 3:30? Like, no, 3 o'clock's good. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, but I live right around the corner from you.
Where do you live? Without giving the address away.
I live less than a mile from you.
So this is easy.
Yeah, I still drove like an asshole. Because I have to pick up my wife afterwards, but yeah, and I would have, and it's uphill, and I would have come in.
That's just, a sweat.
I would have sweat bad.
Yeah, are you a sweater?
I'm a sweater, not really more so than other people, but I have a tendency to always do a workout or always not give myself enough time to cool down from a workout or a shower or a steam before I have to go and do something, and I'll just be fully sweating.
Do you
my
think
clothes.
It's important to sweat when you're working out?
Yes.
What happens when, like, for me, I seem to do the same things, you know, 3 times a week. I go down, I lift a little, but I don't really sweat. Am I missing something?
I think it's just important to sweat. I don't know. I mean, I don't really understand people who don't sweat. I'll do like a power yoga class or something like that, or even today it was at the this gym on the Sunset Strip, and I was doing the same workout as other people, and I was dripping with sweat, and they're not sweating.
But see, you're in wonderful shape. Like, I'm looking at you, and I'm not looking at you in a sexual, well, maybe, but you got a great body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never have seen a bad picture of you. I'm sure there are some.
No, they exist, yeah.
They exist. But, like, I look at you, and I'm like, I'm sort of envious, and then I'm sort of like, God, man, that's got to suck to always be in shape.
It's both. The only time that it's annoying is that every once in a while on the show, I felt like they haven't put together the proper infrastructure. Like, if it's a priority for you, if you guys want me to be shirtless on the show, then why the fuck are there donuts at craft service? If you want me to go work out, build it into my day. Make my call time 8 o'clock, but it's 8 o'clock in the gym, and it's maybe 9:30 in the makeup trailer.
Yeah,
and I've rebelled against, not rebelled, but, you know, I've just, every once in a while on the show, they'll be like, we want you to do this shirtless thing. And I'll just go, no. I mean, I didn't know to say no in the early days of things, but.
Yeah. Have you taken enough pictures, Rob? I mean, how many clicks can we get? Jesus Christ, guys, doing a photo shoot. You know, I'm waiting for you to go, stop taking the goddamn pictures. Rob and I have a really good relationship.
I've noticed on the show, listening to the show.
Yeah, this is so cool. Like, when you get friends, peers, other celebrities that, like, listen to the show, mm-hmm. It's kind of like, I love that.
The first time that I heard the show was somebody who actually covered Smallville, this guy Craig, who now...
Craig from Kryptonsite.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So he now does the equivalent for Green Arrow and Flash and Supergirl. And
such
and
a nice guy.
Super nice guy. And I met, like, one of the first times that I met him at Comic-Con, I got to introduce him to John Barrowman, and it was like, he's a good guy and does good work for the show.
Right.
But he mentioned the show that you did with Tom Welling.
Smallville. Yeah.
And I had never heard Tom speak or be interviewed or...
Yeah, he's a real private guy.
Or anything. And as a result of him being private, you know, he's mythologized to me. You know, like, all the stories that I hear about him, I'm sure are like these kind of wise tales that exist, because the first time that I met him, be it like his behavior on set or his salary or
you know, where were you hearing this shit from?
I'm hearing it from crew members in Vancouver who worked on Smallville.
Right.
We had a ton of people,
sure,
who, you know, and they still wear the shirts from the 200th episode party,
oh,
or like,
God,
the wrap party or the final season, or like, we got
John, JD still on there.
JD is still on.
Oh,
there.
Oh, what a great, yeah. I remember snorting my nose, did some coke with JD back in season one. He goes, yeah, bud. I go, dude, I want to hang out with you. We gotta hang out. He's like, you sure, buddy? That's how he talks, right? Like, yeah, okay, all right. And then we went out one night, we snort. I don't know if he doesn't do it anymore, but we just got really coked up, and you know, I don't do that anymore either, but I'm just being honest and open. You didn't know a lot about Tom, other than you heard these stories on Tom from the other crew members and, like, just these ideas.
The ones that I hear are that he wore shorts all the time.
Sandals.
Sandals.
Oh, yeah, because he would get really hot. He's like, what are we at? Royal Waster?
pants are coming off. And I started doing it. But then I couldn't be in character because Lex Luthor without pants.
Sure.
I had to be somewhat in character.
Sure.
So me wearing short, I couldn't.
I can't even change out of dress shoes that are uncomfortable and wear sneakers or something like that, even if it's a close up.
Because you just feel like you're out of character.
That's right.
I get that. Yeah. And I'm a guy who can jump in and out of character. I could be laughing and action and go. But when it comes to like what I'm wearing.
Me too.
Yeah. So can you do that too? Or are you really kind of serious in the zone?
No, you know what? I try to be whatever the person on set needs me to be. If they want to laugh and joke and all that stuff, that's great. David Ramsey, you know, he and I are always goofing around. Same with Emily, but somebody like Paul Blackthorne is incredibly serious and comes prepared down to the letter of the line and
Jesus.
And is a little on the methody side. So
I'm all about focus and all. I just don't understand when someone's doing a TV show every episode, unless it's like a 10 episode like Breaking Bad, how you could stay method, how you could stay without. To me, that's just so much. That's more energy than letting go.
Yeah, and I work based off of the nature of how I have to work in the show, which is that if I'm in there, I'm probably in every scene for the entire day.
Jesus
and
Christ.
I've got a ton of lines, so I learn more the shape of the script and then just roll with the punches, whereas somebody like Paul, he might have episodes where he's really busy and he might have an episode where he's got two speeches. And so maybe you hold on to them a little tighter than you would otherwise. I don't know.
Do you learn lines the day of or the night before? And do you ever say, guys, it's too heavy already. You got to write me maybe one heavy and then the next one's light and then two heavy or something. Do you ever like, we got to balance this out, or you just roll with the punches?
No, I read the script 3 times and that's it.
Wait.
I read.
You memorize lines that fast?
I read the script 3 times because I never know what we're doing on that particular day. It's easier for me to just show up and know when do I start and when do I finish. But I read the script 3 times and then I've been saying speeches as Oliver for so long that by the time we block the scene and have gone through it a couple of times, I know it.
That's it. That's how you work. You read it 3 times and when you get on set you read the lines with the actor or something, but then you got it. Unless it's a big speech. But you don't have big speeches.
No, even then.
Even then.
Because I tend to think that sometimes these scripts are written and I can tell stuff that has been put in the script to satisfy people either at the studio or the network.
Right.
So it's not like I'm going to take a speech that's one thing and put it in a completely different direction. But if that speech has 80 words in it, by the time I say it, it tends to have like 50.
So they let you run with like, hey, I'm going to make this my own. I'm not going to give you word. Are they like word Nazis? Like, you got to hit this.
Yeah. No.
Thank God. If that was the case, would that be a different scenario how you prepare?
Of course. I'm not changing the direction. We're still starting at point A and finishing at point B. And I'm also very cognizant of knowing the entire script so that if I have to say something that's a direct callback to something that somebody else said, then I always make sure to do that. But I just like to drill it down just a little bit.
Now, I went off on a tangent. So we were talking about you started to listen to the podcast. So I'm guessing you listened to Tom.
I listened to Tom. I mean, I didn't even really have any idea what his voice sounded like.
Tom Welling. So my co-star, he was Clark on Smallville. So all you knew was what you heard.
The most popular stories are, as you guys got into the later seasons, Peter Roth would fly up on a private jet and ostensibly beg Tom to do another season. And I had to bring this up with him almost immediately.
Detroit.
D.C. The first time that I met him in D.C.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he just looks at me and he just goes, no.
That never happened.
That never happened.
Well, you know what? Peter Roth, the president of Warner, he did take me out to dinner a couple of times to try and get me to do a couple extra seasons. But at that point, I had done 7 and I was just, it was different. I was shaving my head every day. I was kind of, I felt like I did it.
Yeah.
I did 6 seasons, 7 seasons. Seasons. Well, you're in your 7th, right?
We're going into 7.
Going to 7. And for me, I was just like, I want to do comedy. I want to do, this is like, it was just hard for me because I'm always like joking around. I always wanted to do more comedy, but I remember those dinners. And I was like, I worked on that network, WB, which turned into CW, for so many years. And I remember I had done so many shows, and I probably, if you add it up, had the most years of anybody. I was a veteran for the CW. And I remember we got that, we were having dinner, and he's like, so where are you from, Michael? you just want, why don't we just cut to the chase? You want me to do an extra season or two, and you haven't done any research. Why do you, your secretary could have said he's from Indiana. Here's this. Remember this? It just, but he was a nice guy. He was out there.
He was a great, he is a great guy.
Yeah, it's not dead.
No, he's a great guy.
He is. He's really.
And, you know, he's old school.
He is old school.
That's the way that my manager describes him. He's old school. I mean, he and I go to lunch sometimes after a season just to chat and just sort of the state of affairs. And whenever he's introducing me to someone, he's like, this is one of our stars. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. There's something.
Yeah, there is an old school Hollywood about it. We had a really good relationship. I think it was sort of severed when I renegotiated. So when you were listening to the Tom podcast.
Yeah.
What did you get from it? Was it exciting? Was it like, oh my God?
I just liked hearing the stories because there's such a similarity between the journeys. Listening to the titular character of a long-running comic book show and just his experiences and talking about some of the crew members that are still there, or Glenn Winter,
yeah.
You know,
went off to direct Supergirl and a bunch of stuff. Great guy. What a nice guy.
He basically set the template for our show. He was the director of photography for the pilot. And then he directed the 16th episode of season one and created this transition shots between the either between scenes or for the first 5 years of the show between the present day and the flashbacks. And again, just sort of the movement of the characters and all the different things that he did photographically became the show.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And he was the DP on that, right? Did he direct it?
He directed it.
He directed the pilot.
No, David Nutter directed the pilot.
David Nutter directed. He directed everything.
One of the things that he said to me when he hired me, because he told me that I had the job several days before I officially had the job, before I'd been approved by Warner Brothers and by the CW, and he was like, "I found Tom Welling, and I found Jared and Jensen, and it was just like, you're right, yeah, of course, yeah." He's amazing. The way that, like, the energy and the spirit that he brings to the pilots. But no, Glenn directed the 16th episode, and you know, like, the pilot's one thing, but you have 17 days and however many millions of dollars, and then it becomes something else when you get into the actual production. And it wasn't really until Glenn stepped in episode 16 that we kind of knew what we had and how we had to do it.
Right. Did you think this is going to be a hit? We were supposed to never think like that, but did you think it just feels like they're putting some money behind this and this is what the world needs right now and this stuff's working? And
it felt like it was going to be a hit. It felt good. I mean, I remember seeing the pilot and showing it to my friends the day that it got picked up. And
they blew you.
Yeah,
all your friends
No, I mean, it starts and they're all excited, but then in the second act, there's this scene where I am being tortured and I chase down and murder these three guys.
It gets dark.
It gets real dark, yeah. Real fast, and I snap a guy's neck at the end of it, and my cousin Robbie pauses it right when it goes to commercial, and he goes, "What the fuck?" And I was like, okay, I think we're headed in the right direction.
Isn't that something? Because you had done a lot of work. Like, you were on Hong, right?
Yep.
You were always doing series and movie of the weeks and just like doing a bit of everything. You know, you're out there, you're hustling and doing your thing. And like, and then boom, this is the big, the big show, right? Smallville was a big show for me.
I got 9 jobs before I got Arrow, moving to LA in 2010.
Beverly Hills 90210.
Beverly Hills 90210.
Right.
That was an critically important one because that was the same casting director as Arrow.
Who was the casting director?
David Rappaport. He's done all of
the... And they called you in. They said, I want Stephen Amell to come in here for this part.
I was the first guy who auditioned.
I was the 700th guy who auditioned.
Really?
I was an afterthought, Stephen. No one thought of me. No, that's not true. Kathleen Lettery was always a big... You need that. You need that champion. You need somebody in your court, wherever you are, that just like can say, hey, I believe in him. He could do it. And I was always doing comedies.
Right.
And you probably like... I mean...
I did a lot of comedy. Hung was a comedy.
Right.
New Girl was a comedy. I did a show back in Toronto called Rent-A-Goalie. That was a comedy.
Right. Hockey?
I played hockey growing up, yeah.
So can you still get on skates and float around? You should come with me on like a Monday. We could rent the ice out.
Okay.
There's a couple guys I know, and we could just like get a couple goalies and just shoot around, skate. You should start getting into hockey. That's my sport.
I know.
And you're Canadian. You I need know. To. You are Canadian, right?
I am,
Toronto.
Yeah, Toronto.
And you're a big Maple Leafs fan.
I'm a Kings fan.
But you're a big Maple Leafs fan.
Mm-mm.
Not anymore? No.
No.
What about the old days? Wendell Clark, no. Ty Domi?
Look, I'm born in 81, and the Leafs had two good years. They in 92 and 93, they made it to the conference finals. And I was in on those playoff runs. And that was Doug Gilmore and Wendell Clark.
Yeah.
And then Matt Sundin came on the team. And I was a fan, kind of, right? But when I moved to L.A., I got season seats for the Kings with my cousin Robbie. And we had a great year the first year in 2011. And then in 2012, they had an utterly mediocre season. And then they just ran through the league.
Right.
And won the cup. And I was in the building. And that's transformative. You're a fan.
That was it. Well, Luke's a real close friend, Luke Robitaille. Yeah. And he was on the show. And it's pretty fascinating, actually, when you're talking to athletes and the same passion they have for, you know, what we have, passion for acting, all this stuff. And his stories and how hard it is. Because being an actor, it's like, you know, you get it's a lot of luck. Luck's a commodity of preparation and opportunity. But, like, it's hard to get breaks. You could be working or not working. There's millions of great actors out there. Not maybe millions, but a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with hockey. He got drafted, but that didn't mean he made the team. And he had to go, you know, the first camp, they're like, you got to get tougher. Next time he got tougher, he started a fight, got laid out. They go, stop fighting. But she goes, went to another camp. And it was just like, it's everything's hard, but you got to work at it. But
I only got Arrow because Hung got canceled.
Is that true?
Yeah. The third season of Hung did better ratings, from my understanding, than the first couple of seasons of Hung. And it was very well received critically. But they basically wiped the comedy slate in December of 2011.
Were you bummed at the time?
Yeah, sure. I was working on Private Practice at the time, which was the first job that I ever got as an offer, and was ironically working with Amy Brenneman, who was my love interest, who worked with Tom, and he was her love interest.
That's right.
And she's like, you're going out for this show, Arrow? She's like, you're going to get it. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, Tom Welling got Superman because of me, all right? You're going to get the Green Arrow because of me. But if it doesn't get canceled, I'm just not available. I can't go do it.
Inside of You is brought to you by Netflix. Battle Creek, Michigan, 1963. Kellogg's and Post, sworn cereal rivals, race to create a pastry that will change the face of breakfast forever. A wildly imaginative tale of ambition, betrayal, and menacing milkmen, sweetened with artificial ingredients. Unfrosted stars Jerry Seinfeld in his directorial debut. It features a supporting cast of comedy greats, including Melissa McCarthy, Jim Gaffigan, Hugh Grant, Amy Schumer, Max Greenfield, Christian Slater, Sarah Cooper, Bill Burr, and many more. Friday, May 3rd, only on Netflix. Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. This is an amazing platform. I use it on both podcasts. It has worked wonders for me. It's so amazing how easy it is to navigate. If you want to sell products, t-shirts, soap scents, whatever it is, Ryan, you want to sell, this is the way to do it. You could see what your best seller is right there, analytics, how much you're making this month, what products are selling the best. It's really fantastic. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify's there to help you grow.
Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way.
Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/inside now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/inside.
Do you remember that audition? Do you remember like when you auditioned for Arrow? Like, you know, we what I call false bravado. Like, you know, it's just like you sometimes, do you ever fake that toughness? Like, I'm confident, I'm this, but sometimes inside you're going, oh my God, I'm shitting my pants.
I felt very at ease during the audition. I remember every bit of it. So it turns out that Greg Berlanti, who shepherds all of these projects, it was at his office on the WB lot, and he had said to David Rappaport and some of the EPs that were in there, going back to my office, come get me if someone's interesting. And so, of course, I get in there. David Nutter's in there as well. And I read the first two scenes, and he's just leaning real far forward in his seat and staring at me with this sort of weird grin on his face.
You're the guy.
He said, do you mind waiting outside for a second? I said, okay. And they went to Greg's office, and I'm like, Greg, we have the guy. And Greg was like, you guys are just excited. You don't have the fucking guy. It's been 10 minutes. And David came back out.
Was this before you read or after you read?
This was after I read.
After you read.
And David came back out in the hallway and grabbed me. And I went back into the room, and all of a sudden there were 11 or 12 more people in there.
Did you have to read again or no?
Yeah. And I'm looking for the note. What do you guys want me to do? I mean, what do you want me to do different? And David said, could you start the second scene facing away from us and then turn around? And I go, is that it? And he goes,
so they are looking at
your ass. He goes, yeah, sure. And I did it again. And again, no notes.
Were you having fun? Or you
I was having fun. It was a very serious scene, but I was having fun, sure. And then they're like, okay, thank you. And I left, and I got a call from my agent, or I called my agent.
You need to work on your ass, Steven. Is that what your agent
said? Right. And I'm like, I know that this is not how this works, but I'm pretty sure that I just got that job in there. And test deal came through within an hour. And then David brought me back a couple of times for my audition with Peter Roth and the rest of the WB team, which is a very unique audition. I don't know how it was for you, but you're not, it's not an audition room. You're walking into an office, like an office space with windows and all that stuff. And it's more about, the way that he framed it to me was like, imagine that you're walking out on the Tonight Show. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for you to come into the room, be a little bit outsized and stare everyone down and be a leading man when you walk in there. And I remember
never thought of it like that.
And David also said to me, Peter Roth is a hugger. Which he is. So he goes, walk in there. He goes, give him a big hug. And I did. And he goes, Steven, I hear you're Canadian. And I said, not today, Mr. Roth, not today. and the room laughed. And David just like looked at me with two thumbs up and like wild eyes. I don't think it fucking mattered what I did after that. Like being able to walk into the room.
He liked you. You were likable. Yeah. You were a leading man. Do you remember, like you said, you'd only done 9 things, which were a lot. Mm-hmm. You're doing Hong, but you hadn't been a leading man in a series. And so the deal, as I know this, what networks will do, what they will do is try to give you as little as possible because they think you haven't been a leading man. So we're going to give you whatever. And if it's a hit, we'll give you more money. Did you feel like it was the deal was you didn't care what the deal was?
I didn't really care what the deal was. If they had said you're going to pay us $200 an episode and you didn't work for free,
your agent, the lawyers worked the deal that they could.
It was a fair deal. I had no quote. I'd never been a series regular before. I was a series regular on Hung technically, but I wasn't going to be bumped up to a series regular price until the fourth season, if there was a fourth season, which there wasn't.
Yeah.
But it was a very, very fair deal. I mean, the first thing they did was try to hire me as a Canadian.
Oh, that's a no-no.
And that was a big no-no.
Say, explain what that is. I mean, if you do that, you're getting paid
less money and you're not getting any residuals.
No, could you imagine it? No residuals if you're a Canadian.
No, they pay
you
Canadian.
And that's what they try. Isn't that something?
Well, I mean, that's
cruel.
That's the first conversation that they have. And my agent shut it down immediately. And basically the business affairs person, you know, comes back semi-embarrassed and goes, you know, I got to ask
because if I can save the company money, I'll get more money.
That's right.
And that's what it is. When did you know your value? You knew that this show was a hit. You go, usually it's after season 2, you renegotiate. That's when I think we did it. And you're like, you know what? I got to change some things around because, you know, when you mm-hmm. first dive into a show, you're like, I'll do whatever. Yeah, of course. Force my call. Bring me in at whatever hour. I'm malleable. And then it comes a time where you're like, no, I got to get sleep better. You guys got to be ready. Like, I'm ready with my lines. Mm-hmm. You guys got to be ready on set. Mm-hmm. All these things happen. They sound like they're trivial to people who aren't in the industry. And they'll sound like, oh, come on. It's acting. How hard it could be. But when you're a leading man, which you are, and you're doing 16-hour days, there comes a time you're like, no, you can't force me tomorrow.
That happened very early for me. That happened in episode 8.
Do you remember? You remember exactly?
I remember exactly where it was. In the early days, we didn't do a lot of reshoots, but they were not happy with a couple elements of episode 5. They couldn't figure out how to have Oliver interact as the Green Arrow with people that he knew, which it sounds really simple. Give him a fucking voice modulator. But that was like the 7th idea that got kicked around. So we tried a bunch of scenes.
Were there accents? You're trying to like, hello, fellas.
No, it was like, you know, one of the ways they did it when I first started interacting with Laurel is they had us like 60 feet apart from one another. And we were wearing earpieces and whispering and stuff like that. It makes no sense now, but we had been working 6-day weeks for a couple of weeks.
Like brutal.
Yeah, coming in Sundays and doing that. And I'm in the Arrow costume. I've got the fucking eye makeup on. And it was 11:15 at night or whatever. The second assistant director said to me, your call time tomorrow is 11:15. And I said, I'm not done for the day. I can't. Base camp is 20 minutes away. I got to take my eye makeup off.
That's not my turnaround.
It's not my turnaround. I'm exhausted. I'm going to take my turnaround. And he says, contractually, your call time is 11:15 and I don't have to give you any explanation. And I said, okay, I'm going to tell you this right now. And I'm going to do it in front of people so that everybody knows this. I'm going to get in the car tomorrow at the exact time that I get in the car tonight and not a minute sooner. And if you had handled this with a little bit more tact, maybe we could have done something, but you didn't. So when everybody asks why we're starting later than everyone wants to, you need to tell them that it's your fault.
Wow.
And you do get pushed around, but I recognize my value, I think pretty early on. But when you get into that first renegotiation, it's weird because it becomes, I mean,
it gets personal in a weird way.
It does get a little personal. The only issue that I had in the first couple of years was I think that up until the end of the second season, I was the 4th or 5th highest paid cast member because I had no
what?
Because I had no quote. I had no.
But
quote.
You're the lead.
I know, but you know,
right. It's no, just right. The way that it, I think that's the way it was. Even in Smallville, I was sure. Making more than Tom in the first yep. year. But then, of course, things
I remember
changed. And I had no problem with him getting more than me. The guy right. was working every day, and he was the lead. I was the second.
So they gave me what they term as a gift after season 2. So it's them raising my salary without asking for anything in return. And my thing was very simple. I just said, you know, quite frankly, I think that I work way more than everybody else. And especially in season 1 and season 2, it was way more disproportionate than it is now. And I think that somebody was making X and they're like, okay, your new salary is going to be X minus like $1,250 per episode. And I go, what are you doing? That's not the most amount of money. And they said, yeah, no, it's the most amount of money over the course of 23 episodes because the person above you is not all episodes produced. I was like, Jesus. Okay. Technically, you're right, but
here's what I want.
That leaves a little bit of a shitty taste in my mouth. Just a little.
It's amazing you say this because I don't care where you work, mm-hmm. whether you're working a 9-to-5, whether you're working at, like, I worked at a grocery store, I worked at McDonald's. Did you ever work at McDonald's, Rob?
No.
Did you work at any fast food restaurant or any restaurant?
No, I worked at a Great Clips, though.
A what?
Great Clips.
What's that?
They cut hair.
Were you a hair
no,
guy?
No, I like clean the combs. And
you clean the shit up?
Work the cashier.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Steven, you're cool. Going to get a kick out of that.
And, yeah. and a movie theater. As a projectionist.
Really?
You knew that.
Yeah, I did. I knew that. So what I'm saying is, if your company is doing really well and you're working really hard, it's just common sense. It's like, hey, the company's doing really well. I'm an integral part of that. I'm a hard worker. I show up every day. I do what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I think it's a no-brainer is what the fuck it is. Mm-hmm. To me, if business is booming, Why wouldn't I want my employees to benefit and be happy to come to work every day and say, hey, and not try to say, let's use your Canadian thing. It's always business. And they always say you have to separate business from...
We're actors and we're sensitive and we take everything personally. And so it is difficult. It's also difficult to argue with Warner Brothers Television because they're prolific and they've been in business forever.
We'll replace you.
Well, sure.
We'll give some other guy eye makeup.
Sure. I'm the entity of Arrow is bigger than me. I am replaceable.
You're not replaceable. They're not replacing you. They wouldn't replace you even after a season. They know the charm. They know whatever the reason is successful. It's called Arrow. It's about you.
Sure.
And so you have to know that value at the same time instead of not being cocky, but you're like, hey, I'm Arrow.
Yeah.
You know, I don't wanna be a dick. I don't wanna ask for too much, but I also wanna get what I deserve.
Yeah. When I did my renegotiation, it was not the most
fun.
Yeah, well, it wasn't fun. It actually wasn't fun because I have a lot of friends who have been in similar positions, and I knew what the actual numbers were, right? So when someone's telling
you knew Tom's number,
I actually did.
You did?
Yeah, I'm very good friends with Jared Padalecki, and he shared information with me that Tom shared with him. And it's everyone trying to help one another out,
right?
And I have gone on to share that information with people that I think it might be beneficial to.
Right.
But when you're hearing final offer, I heard final offer and I went, that's cool. I'm good with my current deal. And then there was dead silence for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then we were about to shoot our big crossovers that we do that I didn't have a contract for. Because I hadn't signed a contract
now,
for them.
You started, when you say crossovers, this is you doing
Flash.
Supergirl, Flash.
Legends.
Now, are you doing that during the season?
Yeah.
Now, are they shooting the scenes where you are?
What do you mean?
Like, if you're crossover, you're doing a crossover episode, you're doing an episode of Supergirl.
Right.
But it's just, you have a couple scenes in there?
It started out, Oliver and Diggle and Felicity went to Central City, and then Barry and Iris and Cisco came to Star City, and that was it. And that was still difficult though, because they just treated it like a normal run of production, but the schedules are staggered and Flash is starting their eighth episode. Well, we're still on our seventh episode, but then they're getting into their ninth episode before we're done our eighth episode. And because the crossovers would happen in the eighth episode, and there was just no wiggle room. It wasn't until this year that they started building in down days to the production. So certain productions would just go dark for a couple of days so that you could actually move the actors around.
Jesus. So would you fly to LA and do something and then they fly to you? And
they're all in Vancouver.
All the shows are in Vancouver.
They're all in Vancouver. The first year of Supergirl when it was on CBS was in LA.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And then they moved to Vancouver.
And how do they do that? They're like, well, I guess whatever your salary is, you get for that show. They have to put it in their budget.
That's not how they wanted to do things, actually.
They want to do, because I've never heard of anything like that. Like, I was never asked. We were the first show,
right,
before everybody, so there wasn't any crossovering.
Well, my feeling was, because the very first time that I did it was going and doing the pilot of The Flash, and it was one scene. It doesn't matter if you're getting one scene. You're getting one scene of an established character that I'm used to getting X number of dollars to portray in an episode of television.
Right.
So that there was a little bit of animosity, but when it actually came for a proper renegotiation, I decided that I thought it would be advantageous for me to take a slightly lower amount on crossovers, because ultimately my financial incentive on the show revolves around my episodic fee. And so I'm only going to be going to do The Flash or Supergirl for, there's only so many hours in the day.
Right. Maybe a day of doing stuff.
But now, amazingly, it's just turned into full, episodes the way that they shoot the crossovers.
Is it hard to keep track?
It's very hard. That's four scripts that I have to read three times. And I always take some time during the crossovers to take a second, because you're also talking about four different directors too. And one through line of a story. And, you know, I always take some time with the directors to just go, okay. Where are we? Uh-huh. Which show? Mm-hmm. That's going to be hour three? Yep. Okay, what just happened? And just make sure that I know where I am.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's hard enough being like, I could barely be in one set going, where are we?
Yeah.
What are we doing? It's like, we're at the Luther Mansion. I mean, yeah, so if you're, God bless.
I love going to other sets. The only—
it's refreshing, right?
Right. Yeah, it really is. The only thing that I would change about the crossovers is that I would, off of the story, I would create one master list of characters and I would give everybody numbers. Right? Like,
right.
And if people don't know what you're talking about on, you know, on Arrow, I'm number one and David Ramsey is number two and so on and so forth. But when I go over to Legends, I'm number 77, right? Right. And
you know where you are.
And I, you know, I would be on Legends and it would be advantageous, not just for me, but for the entire crossover as a whole, to within the context of that episode, if I have the most to do in the crossover and I did this year, treat me like number one, as in prioritize my time and get me out of there so that I can either go to another production or be rested for the following day.
Right.
But each show prioritizes their own actors, and that's fine. I get it. I just would do it differently.
What's your favorite show to cross over on? Favorite group of actors?
Well,
I know that's hard to ask you that.
No, Flash is my favorite show to go to because there's something special about doing scenes with Grant. There's always—
Grant's such a great guy.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't really know each other, but I wanted to get him on here because he just seems like such a great guy.
He's, you know what? I love doing scenes with him. I mean, there's just something about the
dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different energies. Different,
yeah.
Like fun energies.
Yeah.
You do 22 episodes a year. Is that right? Still?
We do 22 this year. We did 23 for the first 6 years.
Plus crossovers. So you're looking at 28, 30 episodes a year. I'm guessing you work 300 days, it seems like, out of 365. What is it?
Oh, God. I don't even know. And it's ironic, too, because when I first moved to LA, I based success. It completely revolved around number of days worked. That was my goal in 2011, was to spend 100 days on set. And
my goal was never that. It's how few days
right.
I could be on set.
If I
worked in an episode and got paid the same for one day, that's a winner.
Sure, but I wasn't. But it,
Rob's looking at me like I'm a lazy.
Well, you're a winner when you're a series regular and you have an episodic fee, and
right.
You know, but when you're not, when you're a guest star,
yeah,
you get you get paid.
You want to be
time.
You want to be
on set.
Well, they always say, right, with an actor, it's like, I want to work. I just want to work. I want to work. All right, you're hired. When do I have off?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I really want to know. So, I mean, you're always working. Here, Tom and I, when we were talking about, could you do this now? He goes, no, I could not do this now. I'm 45. He's 40. Like, you started this when you were 28?
Well, I moved to LA when I was 28. I got Arrow when I was 30.
All right, 30.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, now that you're getting old, how old are you now?
37.
You're 37. Do you think you could have started Arrow right now?
I wouldn't take Arrow right now.
Why is that?
Because my life has changed. I mean, my life is
you got
in
a
LA.
Kid?
My life
you
is know, in LA. I have a daughter. My daughter's
married.
Four. Yeah, my life is different. I understand why I'm still doing it. But if it ended, and somebody came to me and said, "All right, we have a lead role for you on a television show," I would go, before you tell me anything, where does it shoot? And if they said Vancouver, I'd go, okay, but when and how many episodes? And if the number was north of 10, I would say no.
If you said 10 episodes, it's Netflix, it's Vancouver.
10
fine.
Episodes, it starts shooting in June.
It's
excellent.
Just too much.
Thank you very much.
Did you now? How long have you been married?
We will be 6 years this Christmas.
6 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And everything's great.
It's great.
Is marriage easy?
Yeah. It seems pretty easy. We yeah.
Because you were married before.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was for a few
years.
That
sucked.
Now, why did it suck? Because, look, I don't want to say I'm a pessimist. I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, I have this friend, Shira, and she's like, I just don't understand this dating thing. I go, let me tell you something. 99% of the time it doesn't work out. And the one time it does,
yep.
50% don't. So
yep.
You have a 0.5 chance of, and I know it sounds bad, but I'm like, you can't put so much pressure on yourself. And so you're a young guy, you get married. You got to think in the back of your head, like, I want this to be forever, but how many things are forever?
I mean, we got married for the wrong reasons, and I don't have any animosity over the situation anymore, but this was a girl that I met in Toronto when I was 21, 22, and we got engaged when I was 25 or something like that.
Jesus, man.
And then got married when I was 26. And we went through really interesting experiences where, A, I just think that we got married for the wrong reasons.
What were those reasons?
I don't really know.
Just because of maybe the idea of it?
Just the idea. Just kind of the romance.
Old school
of it all.
And
yeah.
Right.
And then I started struggling with acting. And she started realizing how much she loved business, right? I personally think that a lot of the early part of our relationship was her wanting to date someone that her father would disapprove of because he was so business centric. And then over the course of our relationship, she, I think, realized A, how much she was like her father, and B, how much she admired him. And so he passed away tragically in 2009. Ugh. And that put our troubles in a fucking microwave. And a lot of the things that she found attractive in me, she didn't find attractive anymore. And
did that break your heart?
It totally broke my heart. It really did. It was the worst thing that's ever happened to me because, you know, I went to LA in 2009 and I came back and I will never forget. I came back and, you know, I had no money. And I mean, no money at all. Like I was living off of $25 a week that I could stretch at Ralph's to, you know, get mac and cheese and all that, you know, all that shit. And I came back and I'll never forget going back into our apartment and, all of my stuff that I'd left there had been shoved in a fucking drawer that it was too big for, like all my stuff, and just like hastily shoved. And I remember going, oh man, like you didn't want any reminder of me around the house. And then it ended real fast after that.
I mean, did you feel like if you look back and, you know, I mean, hindsight's 20/20, do you feel like you were doing everything you could?
No, I'm equally to blame for sure. You know, I was involved in acting because I wanted to be famous, and that pays that will, you'll never get there.
Right.
You know, some people might. Right. But
yeah.
But
if that's what you're doing it for, it's,
yeah.
Not, it's, first of all, it's not healthy. And I think we've all done it. Anybody who says they haven't thought that when you're 18 or 19 or 20, you're starting out going, I want to be famous. I want to fucking be a big movie. I want to work with Denzel. Everyone goes through that. But then you have to go through, like, do I really love what I'm doing?
Yeah.
Do I really, where's the passion? What's the purpose?
Yeah.
You know?
So it was after, man, I got back in like early December and we were separated and, you know, like just done within like 6 days.
You know, that numbness, right?
Yeah.
That numbness that won't go away, that you're like talking to somebody going, I need to lie down. I think I'm really tired.
Yeah.
It's depression. It's like a crush. Like I was, it's just numbing. Like yeah. You're like something, you died.
She had moved out and was staying at her dad's house. And I went over there and on a Friday night and basically begged her. I was like, I'll do whatever you want. I'll stop acting. I'll, you know, I'll do whatever you want.
Oh my God.
Please take me back. And she just looked at me and she just goes, no. Just cold, flat.
I want to fucking cry
cold,
right now, dude. I'm
flat,
not even kidding around. I want to fucking cry. That's.
And I'd given her her wedding ring was a family heirloom. And I just looked at her and I go, all right, okay. Give it back. And she gave me the wedding ring back that night. And then I walked home and I remember going and I had to teach a fucking spin class the following morning.
Oh my segue. God.
And
faster, you fuckers.
And then I remember seeing my mom and I saw my mom. She goes, how are you? And I go, bad. It's over. It's totally done. Like a fifth grade relationship. It's done.
And did you cry in front of your mom?
Hard. Wept. Like the you can't catch your breath crying. But after that cry, we walked back to my apartment and I phoned up two of my buddies that had really been marginalized because my ex didn't particularly like them or didn't like one of them. And it affected my relationship with him. And my other buddy was getting married the following weekend. And both me and my ex were in the wedding parties. So I needed to talk with him as well. And by the end of that night, I felt like I was...
Part of you is back.
Yeah, yeah. It still took a while, though. It took about a year and a half for me to go for a run and not, when the endorphins started firing in my brain, get really fucking pissed off that the whole thing happened. Like, really, really mad.
Yeah. Do you have, you seem like a pretty even-keeled guy. Did you ever suffer from any kind of depression or anxiety? Did you ever get any of that? Did it carry on through, like, when you're, as an actor with the hard times? And
I think I was depressed towards the end of our marriage in 2009 because I gained about 10, 15 pounds.
And you didn't give a shit.
It wasn't that. It was just like there was something not working with my body. You know what I mean? Like my metabolism, like I was stuck. Like I was like emotionally and mentally and spiritually constipated.
It's scary.
And probably constipated as well. Probably. You know?
I always feel
And I way. Know this because by that Monday, after us breaking up on a Friday, despite the fact that I was meeting all my buddies and going out for Canadian beer, I swear to God, I lost those 12 pounds. They were gone. They shed immediately. Like it was like a weight had been lifted, which it was self-inflicted. It had nothing to do with her.
Yeah.
Just not innocent in the process, but it just went away. Just like
you feel like your libido kind of disappears too.
It totally disappears.
It's like almost like when you go through a breakup, you could put a 25-year-old Cindy Crawford in front of me. And I'm like, yeah, listen, man, Cindy, I don't know, your skin's gorgeous and all. I'll buy some skin products, but what am I, Wilford Brimley right now? Quaker Oats. But, you know, that's how it is, man.
Yeah.
I feel like I just feel so empty. And
yeah, I remember going out a couple of nights later. And again, it was like this tour that I went on to see buddies that I hadn't really spent a lot of time with. And you can, you know, your friends can also tell when you phone them up and you say, I don't care what the fuck you're doing. We have to go out and get a beer. And they're like, okay. And I remember a girl like left a note for me with her number on it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm back.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm back. Doing it. Isn't it? It's like the Rocky story.
Yeah.
You got, this is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get rid of this as soon as we can and stop fucking around. Like you have so much going for you, whatever that is. Get up in the morning, change your routine, go for a beer with your buddies, go whatever. Hang out with Rob, you know, hang out with a 29-year-old. You know, it's like this is the kind of shit. life sounds so cliche. It's fucking short, dude.
Yeah.
It just passes. It goes by so fucking fast.
Yeah.
And you look at this stuff. And then you found your wife relatively, a couple years later?
Yeah, we met in October of 2011.
So 2 years later.
2 years later.
Well, where'd you meet her?
Less than 2 years. She guest starred on my favorite episode of television ever.
Sanford and Son, where they steal from,
it? No, it's the season 4 finale of Mad Men. It's called Tomorrowland. And she plays this girl that comes into the office and is so striking that she basically arrests the office.
But you didn't meet her there. You weren't on Mad Men.
I rewatch my favorite television shows all the time. I find it therapeutic. I find it important as an actor to, having seen something, focus on different things, be it an individual performance or photography or whatever. But I was rewatching it and I paused it and I go, okay, who the fuck is this person? I went on IMDb and I looked around.
Of course.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. That might as well be a dating app. If you see somebody pretty, people think, I don't know. I asked my friend, is that creepy? If like, you know, we met or I see her, I'm like, hey, what's up with that? Oh, look at that. She's single. I wonder if anybody knows her. She seems like my type.
Yeah.
That's not creepy, is it, Rob?
No.
Well, you said that with a little bit of reservation.
No.
I mean, look, it's so hard to date in this fucking town.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think it's okay, whatever, as long as it's not crazy. You meet somebody, hey, what's your last name? Oh, cool, we had a good time here. I'm not going to ask for your number because that's too soon, but you know what? Maybe I'll look you up on Facebook. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. No, I looked her up, and then you get her name, you Google her, you find her Twitter. She's in LA, not a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And she put out a tweet advertising that she was going to be at some event that Adidas was putting on at the Sayers Club in Hollywood.
You went?
I was going.
You were already going?
I was already going. I have no reason to lie. I was already going.
It was like you had to look as good as you could?
Not really. No. I was going to the event.
But you wanted to meet her?
I wanted to meet her. And I was going to the event with my buddy Johnny. And she worked for AEG, so did some work with Sayers and stuff like that at the time. and just saw her, introduced myself, and said, I thought you were great on Mad Men, and then walked away. And she gave me her number.
After you walked away?
Hey, yeah. Steven!
Yeah, later in the night, she gave me her number.
And when was the first date after that night?
Maybe about I think I had her and a couple of her girlfriends swing by my place for football that Sunday, so 3 days later. And then I think I took her out for dinner that week. And then we had, you know, a whirlwind romance that was fantastic. And then that February, I got cast in Arrow, and it got rocky for a little bit, because it's like, okay.
Everything's changed.
Everything's
now.
About to
You're
change.
You're going to Vancouver. You're filming every day.
To say nothing of the fact that I'm going to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And so what are we doing?
Yeah.
You know?
And you didn't know.
We didn't know. So it was kind of, you know, on again, off again. And then everything just crystallized in the...
You kept going back for a reason. Like, yeah. There's something about her that's unlike anyone else.
Yeah.
And that's also a danger zone, I think, too. It's like, that could be a great story, which it is. And you got married and everything's been great. But there's also that where you go back because you think of, like, the passion. You think about the love. You think about the fun. But you forget about the fucking bananas times.
That's right.
And the bananas times, as long as those aren't too strong.
But she's so easygoing, Michael, that... You mentioned anxiety earlier. She's so easygoing that it gives me anxiety, because I don't think that anybody can be that relaxed.
You envy that? Do you envy her relaxation?
I do envy it. That's one of the things that I get fucking anxiety about, is I envy it. And my friends joke with me that I have horrible cases of FOMO, and I do. And she's just super easygoing. And since I've become a dad, I battle with anxiety every once in a while.
Now, what happens when you get anxiety?
I was doing a ropes course in Moorea, which is in French Polynesia, over the Christmas break this year. We always go away for Christmas break because it's within the context of the show. It's my guaranteed holiday time. So yeah. We go somewhere warm. And I'm up on this ropes course, and it's a ropes course in French Polynesia. You get like a 2-second tutorial, and then they just pop you up there. And I was 40 feet in the air, having to cross this fucking Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom bridge. And my wife and my buddy had gone on ahead, and I'm up there. And I was just like, what am I doing up here? What the fuck am I doing up here? I'm a husband and a father. And by the seventh time a crew member says, be careful, you're my mortgage, you actually realize they actually mean that.
They mean that.
And so I'm up here and I'm going, oh my God, I have hundreds of people who rely on me. Why am I 40 feet in the air on a shitty ropes course in French Polynesia? And at that point, I couldn't breathe. Like, I felt like I felt like I was having a heart attack, and I had an immediate flop sweat. So I feel like there's this giant weight on my chest, but I also couldn't stop my hands from shaking. And I had to wait up there for a guy to basically manually take me through the rest of the ropes course, because I was, and it was like zip lines, because I was as far away as you could get before you could get back and get off.
And this is unbeknownst to your wife, or
that's right.
She's ahead of you.
She has no idea. She has no idea. I have no problem with heights, or didn't have problems with heights. And now all of a sudden I'm starting to have problems with heights. And I got back, and again, I'm drenched in sweat. And wouldn't you know it, Arrow is one of the most popular shows in Moorea. Like 85%.
So everybody's looking at you?
85% of the people on that island knew me. Didn't matter age, gender,
wow,
whatever. They knew me.
Overwhelming right now.
And I'm now around a bunch of people who are about to do a ropes course, and people kept coming up and asking for photos, and I'm just sitting there like hand shaking, just can't get a grip, and that I was having a panic attack.
When your wife came over, did you kind of cry and let go, or
she was just like, are you okay? And I was like, I just need to get out of here right now.
Do you feel like, did that ever happen again? Because I feel like when I had my first anxiety attack, I kept thinking, when's this going to happen again?
Mm-hmm.
When is this going to happen again? And then sure enough, out of the blue, it happens. Or is it just a heights thing? Is it just one of those moments that just happened? It was coincidence? I don't know.
No, sometimes it happens. You know, I think sometimes I give... too much of myself to, you know, fans. And I, you know, I sort of give people too much of a window into me. And every once in a while, somebody will write something that I find deeply hurtful, and I can't shut off my ability to give a fuck about it. Even if this person is totally wrong, even if all that they're saying is just an outward projection of them feeling completely inadequate about their life, it really affects me. And I think I let it affect me because it motivates me to, when someone writes something positive, to give them that positivity back. I don't think that I can take in the positive and do something effective with it unless I'm also willing to let the negative affect me a little bit. Yeah. And so something like this will happen, and it will consume me.
So you have to learn how to disconnect a little more.
Yeah.
If possible.
Yeah.
And that's a good quality to have, mm-hmm. caring so much about your fans. And if, I mean, I know a lot of people who don't read their letters, who don't read their tweets, or don't.
Sure.
And you have so many millions of followers that how could you read everything?
Yeah.
You post something, you can't read 10,000 comments, but you'll read a couple or you'll read whatever, because that can be consuming. And, you know, it's easier for me. I don't have millions, but
right.
But I definitely feel like I'm not obligated, but I feel as a human being, like for me, it's happened before where somebody says, I wanted to come see you at the show, and now something happened to my grandfather and I'm a mess and this, and I followed her on Twitter and said, follow me. And then she direct messaged me. I go, what's your address? What's your, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll do those things, or I'll call somebody, or because I feel like if I could do anything to help someone feel better,
that's right.
That's purposeful. I feel good.
Yeah.
It makes me feel good to make them feel good.
So, that's fine.
But if you overdo it and that consumes you, mm-hmm. You have a family to have to take care of. You have work that you have to do 10 to 11 months a year. You have all right. these things. So hey. I can understand that. That's.
Well, I mean, but people also say that they want the genuine article, right? People are like, we like you because it looks like you're presenting a reasonable facsimile of what you actually are in real life, right?
Yeah.
They like it until you make a joke and then somebody takes it way too seriously. And then you recognize that person because you've seen them write like personal attacks at your wife or whatever, because I look at stuff online.
Jesus.
And you just go, you know what? You're an idiot. You're an idiot.
So you'll respond. You'll say, hey, by the way, blah, 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 fuck off.
Yeah, fuck off.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with telling an occasional person to fuck off.
And man, oh man. That,
shit storm.
It's a shit storm.
Do you ever regret it? Like, why did I say something?
Yeah. But you know what? But here's the thing. A couple of years ago, remember there was an instance where a kid brought a homemade clock into a school in Texas, and teachers were like, it's ticking, and like
people... It was like an Indian kid, and they thought he was building a bomb.
Yeah, they thought he was building a bomb. And man, oh man, like these teachers, I'm sorry, but they did the right thing. Like, they did the right thing, in my opinion, and they followed protocol, and fine. And it's not a bomb. And I get all of the public support in the aftermath of that for that student. Well deserved. And I'm sorry that the whole thing happened. As a parent, I would want the teachers to do what they did, right? And if they're wrong and if they're reprimanded because they didn't follow protocol, then they deserve what they got.
Yeah.
But what I didn't enjoy was my wife, who is from Texas, I wrote on Twitter, I'm like, you know, stereotyping Texas isn't really any better than stereotyping this kid. They're kind of the same thing. And man, oh man, that went really poorly.
Just
what I notice about these things is that they devolve away from the original point.
Always. That's
right?
Why it's hard to, there's a lot of times when you look, I feel like you are someone that it's obvious that you just say what you want to fucking say.
Sure.
And you're going to hear it. You're going to get backlash and you're going to say it.
Sure.
And 90% of the time, people are going to love it. He's great. I agree with what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part, you're going to get fucking those people that come out of the woodwork and they'll call me a Jew bastard or they'll do whatever.
And you know, that's fine too. But you're saying like, did you regret saying it? No, I regretted it in this situation that it devolved into someone leaving a link to like a 20-minute video that they put on YouTube about how I didn't understand, couldn't possibly understand what it was like to live as a minority in the United States or in Canada or frankly anywhere because of who I am and what I do and the color of my skin and this. And it was so far away from the original point.
What you were saying at all.
It's not what I was saying at all. No. I admire that person's courage to put themselves out there in a public forum, and I have no ill will towards them, but I apologized. And I regret apologizing more than I regret saying it in the first place, because I was apologizing for something that
wasn't true in your mind. You're like, I'm not racist. I'm not profiling. I'm not discriminating. I'm just saying, I thought that if I don't care who in your head, if it's a white kid who had something that was ticking,
doesn't matter.
Get it. I don't care who it is.
It doesn't matter.
And it's just taken completely out of context. And I think that's like nowadays, it's like sometimes I feel like tweeting because I read something and I said, take a step back. No, you're not tweeting anything. You're not getting involved in this. You don't need, your opinion doesn't mean anything. They're not going to give a shit if like Michael Rosenbaum wants to say something about that. You know, I almost regretted saying something about the new Star Wars movie, but I said it anyway in a small little tweet. By the way, do you like Solo?
I haven't seen Last Jedi. I've seen The Force Awakens.
Force Awakens. I thought that was pretty good. I thought J.J. Abrams did a good job.
Yeah, I haven't seen the. I haven't seen a lot.
You haven't seen a lot. You don't watch a lot of movies.
Mm-mm.
What kind of movies? You like a horror movie fan?
I like horror movies.
Did you see Hereditary?
Mm-mm. I haven't seen that. I watch. You know, my wife and I have our shows that we watch, and I have my shows that I watch, but not get into the movie theater a ton.
Yeah, you probably don't have a lot of time.
Mm-mm.
What are you going to do after Arrow? What would you like to do? A lot of times, I said, I'm taking a break. Would you like to take a year off?
No.
You want to go right back into work?
One of the issues that I have with the show, and it's the nature of the show. It's not a new thing. Is that I don't really have the ability right now to be aspirational elsewhere because of how many episodes it is. And so, you know, I worry sometimes about being the guy that people will think has only ever done Arrow. And I worry that, you know, if I stay on the show through 10 seasons, and I respect people that do that. I have great admiration for Tom staying for 10 years or for Jensen and Jared, you know, going into year 13 or 15 or whatever it is. I also have respect for you going, you know what, I did 7 and I'm good. It's time to move on. I worry that if I stick around until I'm 40, is there a chance that I sacrifice the next 25 years of my career because I maybe stayed a little too long?
Well, I think, you know, I would say my gut is if you're doing 7 seasons and you do 10, you're a good-looking, talented guy. I don't think another 3 years making a lot of money and your family being secure for the rest of their lives and not ever have to worry about anything, and now you're what? You'd be 40?
40.
You're going to be, it's a new chapter of your life, and you can make decisions. And by the way, is it such a bad thing to say, hey, I don't have to work anymore if I'm not doing what I want, or maybe produce your own shit, or hire some good writer to write a great script, or buy something and have it made? There's so many opportunities that I wouldn't look at it like that. I would look at it like I looked at it. Mm-hmm. I looked at it like I can't do anything else. This is 7 years of this character, and I have done everything I can for this character. I can't do anymore. I'm not evolving, and I feel like I'm a comedian. I feel like I want to be funny.
Yeah.
I want to do things different. I want to go direct. I want to do all these things. And could I have stayed 3 more years? Yeah, to me, it wasn't about anything other than I did it. I'm ready to move on.
Did you ever go back?
I went back for the series finale.
Good.
And that's because I wanted to do it for the fans. I didn't want them to one day say, why didn't you go back? I want to go. And I wanted to see everybody. It was the last episode. How could you not have Lex Luthor in the final episode of Smallville?
Sure.
So, of course I did it. And I think that was the best decision of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to just not think about, well, what's going to happen to my career? I don't think there's a big difference what's happening to your career 37 to 40. You're not going to look that much different.
Nope.
You're a young looking guy. It's a matter of like, it gets to a point where you're like, okay, how tired are you? If you're fucking really tired and you're just like, I just got to do something else. And it's just like the passion isn't there. And you're like, that's different.
The passion is still there. 100%. And we have a lot of new blood on the show right now, which I think is important. But you bring up a good point. This is what I have been thinking about. What else does my character have to do? Like what else?
Die.
That's the only thing left for him to do.
Can the Arrow die?
Sure, he doesn't have superpowers.
But, I mean, could...
I think the only thing, whether he dies or not, and I find it incredibly difficult to believe that would ever happen, you know what I mean? I don't know that anyone would allow themselves to be cornered by, like, killing the title character of the
show. I honestly think that would be a great idea.
I mean, I think it would be a great... I think
I'm going to get so much heat. No. All I'm saying is this. I'm going to let you finish. But I'm thinking, what if at the last episode of Arrow, whatever that is, Arrow does die?
Mm-hmm.
But then something else can happen. We realize in another show or whatever that he wasn't dead. It doesn't matter.
The only thing that is left for him to do, and he doesn't have to die to do this, is he needs to leave a legacy because we have all these other shows that exist. So whether Arrow continued on in the absence of Oliver Queen or someone else took up the mantle of the Green Arrow,
he has a child.
Could
little sure. Arrow, also called Laro.
He does have a child, but he's like 12 on the show.
Yeah, he's 12. Maybe a little girl who's going to be the future of...
Who knows? But I think leaving a legacy is the one box that is left to tick for the character.
Well, that's either something you got to think of if you don't do three more years. What are you doing? You're doing season 7?
My contract's up after 7. So
you got to make some decisions here.
I think there's going to be some clarity on my future on the show soon.
Maybe there's something they could do where it's like, hey, I'm not going to give you another 3 years or 2 years, what you want. But you say, hey, let's do a year-by-year thing. If I do 7, let's talk about 8. Now there's not going, oh, my God, I got 2 more years of this or 3 more years.
No, actually, I think that it was a very interesting feeling once we were picked up for season 7 because all of a sudden I saw the finish line. Even if it's many, many years from now, that will be up to me and not up to the studio who has had me under contract willingly. I signed it.
Right.
I have no regrets that I signed it. But every year it's like, we're going to pick up another season. You have to come back, right? Season 8 would not be that. So we're talking about it.
I like it. What would you like to say to all the fans out there who have been supporting you? I mean, you got one of the biggest fan bases I've ever seen a show like this. It's just extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, man. It's incredible. And all the people that I've met, the people that, you know, have been along for the entire ride. John Barrowman during the first season said, you know, you think that your show is the most popular when it's out and when it's on all the billboards and when it's, you know, in the public consciousness, but that's not true at all. It becomes more popular year over year because you get people who, you know, spend the better part of a decade with you in their living room.
Yeah.
And you become like family.
And they reintroduce it to
other people. Yeah. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, the kid that says to his mom, you know, I turned my mom onto the show and my mom, and like I went back to the beginning and my mom and I sat there and binge watched 6 seasons on Netflix. And it's really extraordinary. People are so kind and so thoughtful, and I'm just so lucky to be involved in something that has been so captivating for so many people. And the stuff that they've shared with me is, it's life-changing, man. And boy, oh boy, I'm sure you know this. It's one thing in Canada and the United States. It's an entirely different thing when you go to I was just in the Maldives.
Jesus.
And it was like, Everybody knew the show.
Yeah.
Everybody knew the show. I was in Istanbul. Everybody knew the show.
Yeah, Tom and I are going to Paris in October.
Everybody knows.
We're going to Paris. We were just in Australia. You were in Australia. It's like,
couldn't
it's
move
extraordinary.
On,
how lucky are we? It's a fucking not, lucky thing.
Couldn't move on the streets of Sicily. Couldn't move. It was just like everywhere
incredible.
I went.
Incredible.
It's incredible. It's more than I ever could have asked for. So if, you know, if people are listening to us talking right now and it sounds like we aren't grateful. I'm internally, eternally grateful for this opportunity. I could go on to do things that people think are way more significant or a bigger profile or the movies or whatever the case may be. Arrow will always be the most important thing that has ever happened to me professionally, ever.
I think it's the same thing with Smallville. I think, you know, incredibly fortunate. And, you know, but I think the most important thing probably is the whole fuck cancer movement what you did for that. And you're heavily involved in charities, which it's easy to be, it's not easy to become famous, but it's easy to, you know, you go out there and be an actor and enjoy all the benefits, all this shit. But you do a lot of charity work. You do a lot. I mean, I think that means a lot to you.
It does. It's, you know, my mom's a 2-time cancer survivor, and it's all happened very, very, very organically. You know, the Fuck Cancer campaign are the things that people think about, and it's sort of what comes up if you're looking into any philanthropic things that I've done. But I love the campaigns that, like, there was a young girl, Sophie, who was and is battling a brain tumor. And, you know, we just took a simple GoFundMe page and I was like, look, I'm going to sign a couple of things, but we'll organize a draw. I'll have her mom organize a draw, but, you know, just go on and give $2. But like $5 gets you a ticket and you just get in the draw, whatever. We raised like, I don't know, like $100,000+, just people giving $5 at a time, $10 at a time. It's, you know, some people would come on, they give you $150. And it was just like to see how kind people are. It's one of the reasons when I see someone just being so violently negative over nothing that I just want to go, I don't believe you. I don't.
It's hard.
I don't believe the indignation. I don't believe it. So anyway, not to steer it back to the
no.
But no, I love doing charity work. It feels great. As long as it's something that whatever I do, it has to be something that I'm passionate about.
Right.
Right. Like I got offered an endorsement deal for a fast food restaurant and
I don't care. And they're throwing millions at you.
It was
still a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's not, this is killing people. I'm not going to help you out. I'd rather have Fuck Cancer t-shirts or hats and sell 60,000 of them.
Sure.
And, you know, help people.
Then talk about breakfast all day and healthy options at McDonald's.
You're a pretty open guy, I got to tell you. I didn't know. Where do we meet?
The first time we met was game one of the 2014 Stanley Cup Finals.
That was right. That was my Rangers.
Yeah.
And we lost.
My Kings.
And you rubbed it in my face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember Luke helped me get tickets, and he said, you can't wear anything Rangers. And I had a satin Rangers jacket and a mullet. And I look like one of the Hanson brothers from Slapshot, and he goes, you're a fucking idiot. And I go, yeah, I was. But
yeah,
we lost that game. I was really upset. And the Rangers, I don't know if they'll ever win again Stanley Cup.
Yeah, I was filming Turtles in New York when they made a run to the...
Yeah, who'd you play? The voice of...
No, I was Casey Jones.
Casey Jones, right.
Yeah.
Was that awesome?
That was incredible. I think that filming experience and filming in New York was one of, if not the most important things that I've been through as an actor, because I used to be, I used to be very, very particular in terms of like, I need silence on set. I can't have people walking around. I can't hear a cell phone buzz. Like, I can't.
You were one of those guys.
I was one of those guys.
Christian Bale. Shut the fuck up, Rob.
Yeah. And I would have taken myself way too seriously, you know, because again, like, I'm in my early 30s, but I'm like, Arrow just probably had an outsized importance. You know what I mean? But then I went and worked in New York where people are yelling at you during the take.
You're like, hey, you got to learn how to deal with this.
The crew doesn't, it's not that the crew's not professional, but they're also a New York crew and they don't give a shit.
And you had, so you changed your perspective on it.
It just, nothing bothers me anymore.
Nothing bothers you anymore. So you could be on set and all of a sudden you're a different person. You don't need people to shut up. You don't
know.
I mean, look, it still happens every once in a while. You're like, all right, come on.
But every once in a while is different than like, I wanted to institute a policy where people couldn't have cell phones on set. It's just a true story.
So you were a set Nazi?
A little bit.
So are you saying you were a little bit of a dick?
Because
you're such a nice guy with all these great things and the charitable. But you could be a dick as long as you evolve.
I think in the early days, I think relative to now, I was probably a bit of a dick. And now I want to specify, that doesn't mean treating anyone with disrespect. Like, far from that. Not in the slightest. It's just like, we're here to do a job, right? I've asked crew members all the time. I'm like, you know, you guys want to break for 15 minutes and sing a song, or do you want the day to be as efficient and quick as possible so that everyone can get back home to their families? And everyone always says the latter. It's always the latter.
Yeah.
Right.
So get home.
So our set is a little bit more efficient and maybe a little bit less kumbaya than some other sets in Vancouver. And I think that every once in a while that gives me the reputation of being a little prickly. And it's like, well, okay, fine. I also am completely aware that I can't control the perception of people that people have of me.
Oh, God, because so important.
Because you hear about Welling, right? And his behavior. And then you meet him and he couldn't possibly be a nicer guy. And it's like, okay, yeah, definitely all the stuff that I heard was bullshit.
I don't even know the stuff, the bad stuff. No, I mean, we never had a fight. But yes, but you hear people always talk shit. People, I'm sure, going to say, hey, that Rosenbaum, he's an asshole. Mostly Rob here.
Yeah. The worst.
You're always, you know, there's some singer once said, let's give him something to talk about. I don't think that's the right attitude.
No, but I think, literally within a crew, right? Like there are workers who are confident and easygoing. And, you know, I think that on the whole, I think that the crew is incredibly loyal to me because I 6 years, I've never missed a day of work. I've been late once.
You know how much they respect that when you show up, know your lines, and hit your mark, and they have to wait for you? A lot of actors, they don't. It's being a professional, and when they show up, it's the same thing. They're like, oh, this guy's always on time. He knows his shit. We're going to go home. He's not going to be the one that's holding us back today.
But I also think that there are crew members that will attempt to intimidate their subordinates by making me seem like I'm more difficult than I am, so that, you know, if they tell them that they can't talk to me, it allows them to exert control over the person in their department.
So you get a bad rap.
I think so. I think that happens, right? And that, again, it's fine. It is what it is. It's never going
to
change.
You can't control what other people think about. You could try to do the best you can and evolve as a human being, and, you know, let people like have their cell phones on while you're filming.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
It's fine.
All right, quick, some questions here real quick, because I got to get your ass out because I was a little late today.
It's fine.
I got to get you out 10 till. I promised you. Trista K. DeMille. Oh, my God, yes, can't wait to see you. Steven, what is the most memorable thing that has happened in your life that has a huge impact on you? Quick question. We're going to go through these.
The move to LA in 2010 and the way that I felt about myself and my life when I made that move.
What made you want to become Green Arrow?
Paycheck.
Paycheck? You want to get paid as an actor?
Well, of course. It didn't get offered to me.
How sweaty are your balls in the, that's Michael Rosenbaum, his question. I mean, in that arrow suit, do they have,
it is soupy in there.
Do they put an arrow fan?
No.
A ball fan?
That suit has one of two options. I'm either freezing because I'm out in the cold and the leather is trapping in the cold, or I am sweating my...
Does it? But I bet those farts are trapped in there.
No, it's really bad.
You take that off 10 hours later, you're like, oh my God, that was a fart I had at breakfast. What the fuck just happened? LaLame. Yeah, that was LaLame's question about the Green Arrow. When are you going to come out, Sarah Wolfer? When are you going to come out with a new Fuck Cancer campaign? It's time for a new one.
Probably late this year, early next year.
I want to be part of that, if possible.
Okay.
Let's see. Is Lex Luthor coming on Arrow?
Why not?
Okay, you heard that. Ask him if he's still Princess Julie 13. Ask him if he still has a Louisville Slugger I gave him when we were here at WizardCon.
Yeah, for sure. It's sitting in my closet in Vancouver.
The Louisville Slugger?
Yeah, it's either a green one with my name on it or another one that was just the regular sort of Louisville Slugger color, but also had my name on it.
Silver Girl Sin, I think he owns a vineyard. You own a vineyard?
My buddy and I have a winery in Walla Walla, Washington, but we don't own a vineyard.
Okay.
We source and make and produce wine, but we don't actually own any dirt.
We talked about your method of memorization. You read the script three times, and then you pretty much go for it. Favorite travel destination, Amy in Sydney. And thanks for visiting Sydney, she said.
It's going to be tough to top the Maldives. That was heaven on earth.
I like it.
I really like St. Bart's, too. You ever been to St. Bart's?
No.
It's fantastic.
Really?
It's really, really cool.
I mean, you're like a traveler. You're like, you pretty much are doing everything with your life.
My wife demands adventure.
She's like, you have to. You're going to do the show, and when you're off, we're going.
Yeah. And also, I give her, the only thing that I say right now is I'm not trying out new spots over the Christmas break because I need that recovery time. I need to rest. But when it comes to, you know, because we've just basically been around the world, and she gets carte blanche.
I like that. Yeah. Rob?
Yeah?
How do you feel about this interview?
That's great.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So interesting. I mean, I could talk to you for hours. I mean, live around the corner for me. Can you maybe sometime come back again down the road, months from now?
100%.
It's easy. We could just talk, shoot the shit.
Yeah.
What's going on? It's good for the show. It's good for my show. But that's, I think, being a nice person. I think I'm a pretty nice guy. But like, if you never know who you're going to meet.
Oh, you couldn't be more right. And especially because when you meet like super intelligent and highly successful people, they don't they don't give off the sort of vibe that somebody who is like moderately successful but wants you to think they're super successful, like those right. people, those people are easy to spot. But somebody like Jeannie Buss, or like just anyone that I meet that's super duper high up mm-hmm. in either the entertainment industry or whatever their industry is, they're always incredibly soft-spoken and understated and conscientious and intelligent. And so again, you never know who you're going to meet.
Do you ever, have you ever gotten in a fight on set with another actor or a director and just like yelling or really uncomfortable?
It's a good question. I've butted heads with directors before. There was a director in our fourth season that I didn't appreciate. He would talk to me about a scene, right? And he'd be like, I'd like you to try this. And I'd say, I'm not comfortable doing that for the following reasons. And I get crazy about memorization on the show in terms of like, this happened here and this happened in this season. And this is what happened all over here. To the point where I'll have the script supervisor or other people come to me and be like, hey, we got a question for you. And I'll be like, yep. And
because you remember.
I remember. And he said, you know, I want you to try this. And I gave a reasonable response as to why I was not going to do it.
But he still went at you.
And he just goes, no, it wasn't like he goes, if he had stood up and said, hey, I'm the fucking director of this episode and I'm asking you for something and you're the actor and I want you to give it to me and we'll look at it together. But it was like, he went sneaky instead. He goes, yeah, but just like, why don't you just do it anyway? And I was like, okay, I'm done with you. I'm done. Don't sneak me. We've had the cast has got along pretty well. I mean, you're working with people. You're gonna have family squabbles. To tell you one thing I really respected was this year. And also I understand that, you know, there are actors that are friends on the show, but there's a certain element of me that people are always going to think of me as management just a little bit because, you know, anybody can die on the show except probably me, you know what I mean? And, you know, and they probably know that I'll probably get the script a little bit before they do or just have a different and unique relationship with the producers or the director that maybe they don't feel like they have. I get that. Which is why I respected what happened so much. Rick Gonzalez had a speech in episode 9 this year at Oliver and Felicity's wedding reception. And he takes over for somebody who's giving a drunk speech. And it's a very thoughtful speech. And, you know, I need to be cognizant of the fact that that not everyone has big and powerful and interesting and emotional speeches on every episode. You know, some people go through an episode, maybe they have 2 or 3 lines, right? And we were just saying the words. We weren't even blocking the scene. We were just saying the words. And during his first reading of the speech, because I'm sort of joking around in character, I made kind of a flippant remark. Don't remember what it is, right? But it was just meant to kind of lighten the mood. And it's the start of the day. And it's the first scene that we're doing. And didn't think anything of it. Came back to set. And he took me aside. And he said, can I speak with you, please? And I said, yes. And he goes, you making a joke like that really interferes with my process. This scene and this moment in this episode is really important to me. And I didn't appreciate what you did. And I said, thank you so much for saying that. I'm incredibly sorry. It will never happen again. I didn't mean anything by it. It was just a joke. It wasn't even a good one. I'm really sorry, man. But above all else, thank you so much for coming and talking to me about it. Shook hands and it was squashed and it was done.
That's so, yeah.
But because the thing that I'm aware of is that probably 95% of the time, that people get pissed off at
me. They say it right in front of people.
I am oblivious to it. I have no idea because I don't know what I've done. And maybe they feel intimidated and they don't want to talk with me about it.
Or you say something and you say stupid things. We all say stupid shit.
Everybody says stupid shit. And so most of the time that I offend somebody, I am completely in the dark about it. So the fact that he pulls me aside, it squashed. My level of respect for him, which was already high, jumps up even more. Yeah. And then you go on about your day.
Dude, this has been a really good time. Thanks for allowing me to be inside of you. Steven, this has been a real treat. Come back anytime.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker, although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a three-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.